The headlines: Russian troops gain full control of the strategic port of Kherson, the first major Ukrainian city falling into Russian hands on the eighth day of the conflict. The UN Refugee Agency says a week-long conflict has forced at least 1 million people to flee Ukraine. And also, Ukraine and Russia preparing to return to the negotiating table days after conducting their first face-to-face talks with no clear breakthrough. Hello and welcome, everybody. Moscow's military operation in Ukraine is in its eighth day with Russian forces further advancing in the country. The mayor of Kherson has confirmed the Russian troops are now in control of the strategic port city. This is the first significant urban center to fall since Moscow launched its attack. Kherson is strategically important because it links Crimea in the south to Donbas in the east. Russian forces have also struck a radio and television center in Kiev and captured the town of Balaklia near the capital. Heavy clashes are also underway in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. According to emergency workers, 34 civilians have been killed there in the past 24 hours. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says a Ukrainian member of its team was also killed in Kharkiv bombing. Moscow says its troops have encircled Mariupol on the Azov Sea coast. Meantime, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has hailed his people's resilience and resistance.
The morale of the enemy is deteriorating. More and more occupiers are fleeing back to Russia. I sincerely admire the heroic resistance of our people and those that do not allow the occupiers to pass through, blocking everything for them, blocking roads. People come out in front of enemy vehicles. This is extremely dangerous, but how courageous.
Zelensky says defense lines are holding against the Russian attack and that Ukraine is receiving daily arms supplies from its international allies. The fighting began last Thursday after Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine. As reported by the UN Refugee Agency, more than 1 million people have fled to neighboring countries since then. Russia's defense ministry says it has hit over 1,600 Ukrainian military sites since February the 24th. The ministry says it has lost around 500 of its own troops in the fighting. Russia has also put the fatalities among Ukrainian soldiers and those whom it calls nationalists at close to 3,000. So far, there's been no confirmation from Ukraine. We're going to continue with our extended coverage of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We're now joined by our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels for more updates on the European responses to the conflict, and also if there are any updates that you can share with us about the influx of refugees at this point.
That's right, Bart. Yeah, well, you know, there is a lot happening, as you can imagine. At the moment, EU Home Affairs ministers have convened a meeting here in Brussels, and it's being chaired by the co-chaired by the European Commissioner for Home Affairs, Elva Johansson, and she was speaking to journalists on the way into the meeting. And she talked about it being a very, very dangerous and serious situation with regards to refugees. I know that we hear different figures. She says almost 1 million refugees have gone into the EU so far. And I suppose the UN figure is probably correct when you consider Moldova. There are also refugees going into Moldova. In fact, as we speak, the EU foreign policy chief is Joseph Borrell is in Moldova. And it's a non-EU country, but he's there to show solidarity with the people who are fleeing into that country. And I know there's a large cargo plane on its way from France to Moldova as well, carrying supplies to try and cater for the influx of refugees. But the EU countries, of course, affected are Slovakia, Romania, Hungary, and mainly Poland. I mean, you're talking about 500,000 refugees who have already gone into Poland. So it's the country that is taking in most refugees at this point. Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, is currently in Slovakia. She's going to be holding a press conference later. So you have a series of different EU commissioners going to these countries that are worst affected, and obviously there's going to be a huge increase in funding to try and support the refugees. But the language being used by Johansson, the EU Home Affairs Commissioner, when she went into the meeting today, a short distance from here. She was asked about the Dublin regulation. The Dublin regulation, it's in relation to the asylum policy of the EU. It means that if somebody's seeking asylum, whichever EU country they go into first, that country has to accommodate that asylum seeker. They cannot be sent to a different country. That's the Dublin regulation. And she was asked about the Dublin regulation. And to be totally honest with you, she became somewhat flustered. And she says, I don't understand what you mean. And she says, well, the current legislation is still in place. But she said, and I quote, the Dublin regulation is only for asylum seekers. She said, the people coming into the EU are refugees. So that's kind of a major shift in policy. Suddenly, these people coming into the EU, they don't necessarily have to go through the procedures. They're automatically refugees. They've given that status without going through the procedures, which has to be said is in completely stark contrast to the refugees that we've seen trying to get into the EU from elsewhere, from Africa, from the Middle East and Asia and so on, fleeing conflict zones that, of course, we know were created in terms of the destabilization of countries at the hands of Western powers. And these people, there's no doubt that the refugees coming from Ukraine are being given completely different treatment and completely different status and importance, it has to be said, just by going from what we're seeing and what we're listening to by the European Union. There's just no doubt about that. But she says we have to prepare for millions of refugees into the European Union. So that's what's going to happen now in the coming days. Again, more meetings, EU commissioners going to those areas. But also here in Brussels tomorrow, we're going to have a meeting of NATO foreign affairs ministers. So again, from the sort of military element of it, aside from the refugees, today probably be most focused on refugees. And then tomorrow we will get more of the sort of, you know, the military end of things when we have the foreign affairs of NATO meeting here in Brussels.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerome. He was joining us from Brussels. We're now going to bring in writer and political analyst John White, who's with us from Edinburgh. Mr. White, welcome to the program. What are the main circumstances and reasons that have led to the situation right now in Ukraine?
Well, it's due entirely to Russia not being listened to when it's tried to make the case that NATO cannot be allowed to expand up to its western border because it would pose an unacceptable threat to Russia's security. And those protestations from Moscow have been met with dead silence. And the NATO in the West has gone ahead. There's been 5 NATO enlargements since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall and just on the cusp of German reunification, the then Soviet Premier, the last Premier of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, was promised by his counterparts in the US and in the UK, etc., that the NATO would not expand one inch eastward. That was James Baker, the then US Secretary of State, to his then Soviet counterpart, Edward Shevardnadze. So the pledges have been violated, the promises have been broken, and this is the cause of this conflict. It's a brutal, bloody conflict, but blame resides in Washington, London, and Brussels, not in Moscow, in my view.
Let's bring in journalist and political commentator Dmitry Zolotarev, joining us from Irkutsk, Russia. Sir, welcome to the program. In your opinion, were all options exhausted? Were all avenues treaded to prevent the conflict between Russia and Ukraine? In retrospect, could the U.S. and NATO have acted differently to de-escalate the situation altogether? Russia put forth its requests. Ukraine can't join NATO, and no more eastward expansion of the military alliance.
Well, first of all, hello, Bardia. Pleasure to be with you. Well, just like one of former Secretary of State advisors, the General of the United States Army, retired, recently claimed on air of Fox News, he said, "What did you expect from Russia when NATO came so close to Russian borders and when you have been pushing Ukraine towards Russia, towards military conflict with Russia, and going to arm Ukraine with nuclear weapons? So what did you expect Russians to do? How do you think we would act if Russians deployed nuclear weapons on Cuba? We would do exactly what did Putin." So I think NATO did have all the tools to prevent what was going on right now. And I have to say that there is no military conflict between Ukraine and Russia. There is a special army forces operation against Nazis in Ukraine, and in order to demilitarize Ukraine, just to set off the military threat from Russian borders, from European borders, as far as is possible. The Russians have been provoked, brutally provoked to do this. So Putin, 15 years ago in Europe, stated and offered a complete Russia and Europe plan of collective defense. The Europe just defied it. So as a result, what we see is happening.
John White, the Ukrainian president, he recently said that his country has been left alone. Ukraine was expecting a more from the U.S. and NATO. Kiev had assurances in the past that they would be assisted in a time of need. Why is that not happening right now? And why is the U.S. not willing to go to any lengths to protect its allies? We've seen this pattern before, namely in Afghanistan.
Well, Mr. Zelensky is leading a coup government in Kiev, and its government's being used as a cat's paw by Washington and its Western allies to contain Russia, trying to place a cordon sanitaire around Russia. And he's getting a lot of aid, but he wants more. Mr. Zelensky will not be happy until he triggers World War III. His entire strategy is to, and he's been very effective. The optics that he has been able to produce in the West have been very effective in trying to win hearts and minds, albeit on a false basis in Western public opinion. And his entire strategy now depends on dragging the West into this wider conflict with Russia. Russia in the West is losing the propaganda war, but it's certainly winning the war on the ground. And some of the statements that are being made are absolutely frightening. We have war fever in the UK, for example, that is the worst that I have ever experienced and has chilling echoes of the march to war in World War One, which started off to save Belgium, plucky little Belgium. And just on the point of denazification, because there needs to be some clarity introduced into this issue. Not everyone in Western Ukraine, of course, is a Nazi, but the national hero in that part of the world is Stepan Bandera. Stepan Bandera is seen as a freedom fighter in Western Ukraine, when in fact he was a Nazi, and a Nazi, he was a fascist and a Nazi collaborator during World War II. And there are unresolved issues regarding the mass collaboration with the Nazis that took place in Western Ukraine during World War II. As I made a point in a tweet, it was the Russians who liberated Auschwitz in January 1945. Western Ukrainians were the guards. That does not mean to demonize the entire population of Western Ukraine, but there is no other state in Europe that has an armed, uniformed battalion of avowed neo-Nazis incorporated into its armed forces. The Azov Battalion is a battalion of avowed neo-Nazis. They were in the vanguard. These members were in the vanguard of the so-called Maidan Revolution, which was a coup which toppled the last legitimate all-Ukraine government led by Viktor Yanukovych in 2014. Ukraine does have a problem with its history of collaboration and sympathy for fascism and for the Nazis during the Second World War. And that is playing into this issue also.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. Mr. John White, writer and political analyst, joining us from Edinburgh. Also thanks to journalist and political commentator Dmitry Zolotarev, joining us from Irkutsk, Russia. We're going to stay on the topic. A Russian delegation has arrived for the second round of talks between Kiev and Moscow. The Russian team arrived at the Belarus-Poland border, where the negotiations are to take place. The Ukrainian side is on its way and is expected to arrive on Thursday. The two sides are likely to agree on a meeting place, as well as discuss the possibility of a ceasefire and the establishment of a humanitarian corridor. Russia and Ukraine concluded their first round of negotiations in Belarus on Monday with no clear breakthrough. Russia is hit with more sanctions as the conflict between Moscow and Kiev continues unabated. The U.S. government has announced a new round of sanctions on Russia, including measures that ban the export of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, the European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. In recent days, Moscow has retaliated with sanctions and restrictions of its own. Moscow has also warned that Germany's decision to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project could damage ties irrevocably and lead to a rapid and inevitable rise in gas prices. The United Nations General Assembly votes overwhelmingly to deplore Russia's military operation against Ukraine. The 193-member body has adopted a resolution that calls on Russia to withdraw its troops from Ukraine. During the emergency session, 141 members voted in favor of the resolution. Five countries, including Russia, said no, while 35 others abstained. Addressing the meeting, Ukraine's ambassador accused Moscow of seeking to commit genocide in his country. Sergei Kislytsia warned that if, quote, Russia's aggression is not stopped, it will spill over to other areas. However, the Russian representative criticized the resolution, saying it might spark further escalation. Vasily Nebenzia blamed Ukraine and its Western allies for the ongoing conflict and accused them of killing people in the Donbass region. He also dismissed claims that the Russian military had targeted civilians. A senior Iranian official says Tehran's strategy of active resistance has rendered the maximum pressure policy introduced by former U.S. President Donald Trump ineffective. Hours ago, Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani posted a tweet saying that even the current U.S. administration has acknowledged that Trump's policy was a non-starter. The official noted that if the ongoing talks in Vienna do not result in a good deal, it will be a failure for the present U.S. government, because that will mean they've not seized the diplomatic opportunity given to them. The Iranian negotiating team in Vienna is adhering to its stance that no agreement will be achieved unless all of its proposed conditions are met. Under a possible agreement, all sanctions that run counter to the 2015 deal between Iran and world powers must be removed. This process will take months for Iran to verify, and before Iran completes the verification process, the U.S. will not be able to rejoin the deal. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere, it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. You know, everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that we have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat-eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
He's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous bit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already and the, you know, mm-hmm. activists against fossil fuels and things like this mm-hmm. as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the mm-hmm. agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the program. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms. It uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. Mm-hmm. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on. But I mean, when he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. Mm-hmm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
Mm-hmm. It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction. action. It's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and the inhumane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not they'll turn vegan is another matter. Mm-hmm. But they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change and reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, they say, you know, use less coal, ride your bike, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had invited to a meeting with Al Gore and some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushback. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in an Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you talking to all these different organizations. You know, I understand lobbyists, I would expect that from them, and to a certain extent from the government, but from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another,
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. So either they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost again speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been he would have lost.
He would have lost. Yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly. Or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time. Maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
Massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is polluting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet, with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they're monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried, and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learn from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes, because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important, and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject. You know?
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that the funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But yeah, I don't know that. I'm verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, if we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the programme. I mean, he's been criticised for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kazim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kazim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام وفضل الفقيه على العابد كفضل الشمس على الكواكب ومن لم يتفقه في دينه لم يرضى الله له عملا.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "The superiority of a learned person over a worshipper is as the superiority of the sun over the planets, and whoever does not educate themselves in their religion, Allah will not accept a single deed from them."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about these beautiful conversations and these golden dialogues, if you will, about Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. This divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, he taught us so many beautiful things via these conversations with his family members and his companions, his relatives, and the people around him. Of course, we see that the infallible imams, they spoke with people. Even the Messenger of Allah spoke with the people. The messages and the statements that they had weren't monologues. For the most part, they were dialogues. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, he advised his companions to do good to their neighbors. And it's interesting, but he also told them regarding their neighbors to be patient towards bearing harm towards such a neighbor. And so Imam al-Kazim said to his companions in this conversation that a good neighbor is not one who refrains from doing harm, but a good neighbor is one who shows patience towards the harm that is shown to them. Now, if we talk about the first part just a little bit, a good neighbor is not one who refrains from doing harm. Now, of course, that is because a good neighbor should not be doing any kind of harm to their neighbor. And on the other hand, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that a good neighbor is one who shows patience towards some kind of, you know, minuscule harm or unwanted harm that is coming via their neighbor. Now, showing patience towards harm, I mean, harm here is not like if your neighbor is about to shoot you, just stand there and be patient. No, that's a different situation. Here is being talked about, so sometimes, you know, the neighbor's kid might be throwing a ball at a wall and you can hear it. Or sometimes maybe the neighbor's kid's toys are on your lawn. These kind of small things, things that one should not be incredibly frustrated or angry about, and things that one shouldn't make a big commotion and a fight about these kind of things, you know. Of course, it goes both ways. Neighbors should respect one another. Neighbors should love one another. Neighbors should protect each other and be careful of the rights of one another. It is related that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said that the Holy Prophet was putting forth statements in his will and testament about neighbors that we thought that they were going to receive inheritance, like they are part of the family. So the rights of a neighbor and the rights of being a good neighbor in this dialogue by Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Musa ibn Ja'far one day was approached by a servant who was carrying a bowl of hot water. You've all heard this story before. Look at those who are trained in the school of Ali Muhammad, within the family of Ali Muhammad. She drops this hot bowl of water onto the Imam. Now picture yourself, put yourself in the position of this lady. And the Imam, and what would you do? What would you say? How would you reciprocate what had happened? This lady would know how to speak to the grandson of Rasulullah. She would speak to him using the Quran. She would say to him, what? وَالْكَاظِمِينَ الْغَيْضِ, those who swallow the anger. Imam would say, لَقَدْ كَظَمْتُ غَيْضِي, don't worry, I've swallowed my anger. She says to him, وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ, those who forgive the people. Imam alayhi salam says, لَقَدْ عَفَوْتُ عَنْكِ, I have forgiven you, don't worry. She concludes the verse by saying, وَاللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الْمُحْسِنِينَ, Allah loves the good doers. Imam says to her, اذهبي فأنت حر في سبيل الله. Go, you are free in the way of Allah. Not only did he swallow his anger, not only did he forgive her, but he also reciprocated the bad with good. That is indeed what the religion of Islam has come forward to perfect the moral standards of human beings. And that's why Imam alayhi salam emerged with this type of characteristics and these types of virtues. How wonderful it is that when we commemorate the shahada of the seventh holy Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, we begin to re-examine ourselves and our conduct with the other human beings, not necessarily Muslims. How do we deal with them? In which way do we interact with those who may not necessarily give us what we deserve to be given?
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.